We have a great show for you coming up today. We're going to look at the winter impact on certain Michigan fruit crops and how they managed to survive this brutal winter here in Michigan, along with the rest of us. We'll also look at a new locally grown food initiative that seeks to bring more locally grown food onto the tables and the trays of hospitals, school districts, school cafeterias, etc. But first, in case you happen to miss it, the U.S. Supreme Court last week came out with another controversial ruling on our nation's campaign finance laws. In the case McCutcheon versus the FEC, the Supreme Court, in its usual 5-4 split across ideological lines, struck down the limits on the overall amount of money an individual can give to all federal candidates and committees in a 2-year election cycle. The decision effectively raises the individual donation limit to approximately $3.5 million from what was about $117,000. Reactions to this decision, of course, have been polarized, from supporters claiming a First Amendment victory for freedom of speech to detractors claiming the sky is starting to crumble on our democracy. With me now to help sort out what this means for our political climate and for upcoming Michigan races is Rich Robinson. He's the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Welcome back, Rich.
Thanks, Joe. Good to be here.
And also with me is Richard McClellan, a Lansing attorney, experienced in campaign finance, and a longtime state GOP power broker. Welcome back, Richard.
Thank you, Joe. Happy to be here.
First, Rich, just if you will, elaborate a little bit more on just what the justices were looking at in this case.
Well, the argument for having an aggregate limit was essentially to preclude the possibility of shuffling money from committee to committee, circumventing individual contribution limits. That's the bedrock of the argument for the aggregate limits. I think there's also an element of how much can you allow an individual to own of the political process. That really didn't come up into the arguments. But to put this in context, the number of people in the United States who bumped into that limit last election cycle was 591 persons who gave the maximum amount to federal candidates. So that's one out of every 500,000 Americans was having their freedoms infringed upon by this aggregate contribution limit.
Richard, is that your understanding of what the justices were looking at in this case? Do you agree with what Rich was saying there? Anything you'd like to add?
No, I think that I think he properly sets out his side of the argument, and I think that from my perspective. The most telling thing that Rich just said and reflects that broader view is whether rich people should be allowed, he used the term allowed, and the difference between those who want to regulate who political speech and people like myself don't think the question is who should be allowed to speak at what levels and with what amount of money, but whether the government has any good reason to limit such activity or to target any individual or group to restrict their liberty. So frequently this kind of conversation, Rich and I sort of talk past each other. He articulates his policy perspective, and I'll probably articulate mine. And this is what the Supreme Court wrestled with in the McCutcheon case, as they have done really for 40 years, I guess.
And when they're looking at restricting liberty, I mean, they're looking at particularly the definition of corruption, or what would equal corruption. Is that correct, Rich?
That's exactly the point of all of this. And what Chief Justice Roberts said in his opinion is, even though sometimes it gets a little gray about the difference between quid pro quo corruption and dependence corruption, The Supreme Court can only rule on quid pro quo corruption. So, I think what he's effectively done is define political corruption out of existence going forward.
Richard, would you agree with that assessment?
No, I wouldn't. But I would agree that the cases are always dance around this issue of quid pro quo corruption, because that's the only basis that the Supreme Court has ever found to limit political speech. The real underlying effort, however, is to limit the political speech of certain people. So the whole point of the First Amendment is to protect individual speech. This is what Justice Roberts said, that the majority might prefer to restrict, or that legislators or judges might not view as useful to the democratic process. So you have this effort to stop, quote, rich people from speaking in the political sense as much as they want. And we've had it other times in history. We try to shut down other groups of people. Here on Michigan State University 50 years ago, they tried to keep communists off campus from speaking. I was involved in that. So these battles go on and on. But the question is, can the government, under the First Amendment, restrict who can speak? And then you go to the reason. The only reason you could is this corruption idea. I think that that's not the issue. It's really designed to influence, to enhance the relative influence of others if you can shut certain people down.
Well, I think one of the things we're talking about here, Rich, when I hear is speech is money here in this conversation. Is that correct, Rich? Is there a problem that you have with that, that the court seems to be equating speech and money?
Well, absolutely. Speech is an endorsement. Freedom of association is standing up in endorsement of a candidate. Money is property, and the exchange of money is an investment that seeks and usually gets a return on investment. And, you know, the fundamental problem here is that this was a barrier against circumvention of individual contribution limits. Justice Breyer laid it out in tables in the dissent, in the opinion, and Chief Justice Roberts dismissed it as divorced from reality. In my experience at looking how money sloshes around from committee to committee to committee, this is not divorced from reality. This is a fundamental part of American politics.
You know, I think that a lot of times this conversation gets split between conservative and liberal and right and left and that kind of thing. But I think most polls I saw, 75% to 80% of the American public, regardless of political affiliation, would like to see less money in politics and think there's too much money in politics. Richard, you know, why should the average voter or the average small business or nonprofit that wants to participate in the political process but doesn't have the thousands of dollars or even the tens of thousands of dollars be happy with this ruling?
Well, only because they understand and support the U.S. Constitution. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law restricting freedom of speech. The courts have said pretty clearly money does equal speech. And I think that is a fundamental finding that they've made, that under our system, to have speech, you have to spend money. Other people argue that it's really democracy versus property interests. That's what the Voices of Russia website said I looked at this morning. But other people say that, as Rich says, he articulates very well their view. My view is much more pure free speech, political speech being the most important. And even if you don't like the people that are speaking, you can't limit them. You can't limit the amount of speech. You can't limit the amount of money they spend. And because if you're doing so, you are doing so to advance some other interest that you're not limiting.
My name is Joe Lindstroth. I'm in for a current state host, Mark Bayshore. I'm speaking with Rich Robinson, the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, and Richard McClellan, a longtime Lansing attorney, about McCutcheon versus FEC, the Supreme Court ruling last week. Richard, I think that brings up another point on the other side of the First Amendment coin or conversation here, is that what about the right to be heard as well as the right to speak? You know, by protecting such this minute, wealthy portion of the electorate and their right for free speech, are we in turn, you know, conversely drowning out a larger majority of the electorate's voices who can't be heard because of a lack of money? Is there a balance there that might push?
That is what the people that are arguing, they have other people that they think should have more speech. I always think One of the things Justice Roberts says was, it's like limiting the number of candidates a newspaper can support. Well, what if they said the Free Press, Detroit Free Press, could only endorse 15 candidates? So they do want to limit so that other people can have their voices heard. Now, those other voices, the truth is there's almost no organized economic interest in our society that doesn't have their supporters and the money. I mean, to say that there is a lack of funding for these various voices, you just have to have been around 40 years and seen the power the unions used to have, the some of the liberal groups, George Soros, the Republicans used to beat up on George Soros in the same way that mm-hmm. the Democrats beat up on the Koch brothers now. There is plenty of money. Now, does that mean the individual citizen out there has a limited voice? Yes, he or she does. The one thing to remember is, don't forget this, Michigan has no aggregate limits. This McCutcheon case had no impact on state elections. We've never had any limits. So the super wealthy, if they want to buy the Michigan legislature, can do so. And so we seem to be surviving. So no, I don't think that's a valid point that the Constitution doesn't permit it. It just means that if somebody else is going to talk louder, you're going to have to work harder to organize and get your voice out.
Rich, what do you make of that point? Is that a valid argument that protecting this small minority might in turn disenfranchise a larger portion of our electorate?
Well, let's set that aside. I'd like to step back to the clarity of the idea that money is speech. Now, since Justice O'Connor left the bench, yes, the majority, and in this case the plurality with Justice Thomas, have been able to prevail on this idea. Money is just not speech. And the idea in this case that the court could reverse an act of Congress based on a 5-4 majority, that's not clarity, and that's liable to be reversed with the next new appointment on the court. Justice Breyer said in his dissent, if you're doing this, shouldn't you have a record? And he included in his dissent a lot of the record of members of Congress who are familiar with politics talking about what it is that money, how money corrupts the process. It was clear to members of Congress, you have a Supreme Court now, since Justice O'Connor left the court, where no one's ever run for public office at all. No one has experience with what the meaning of money in the political process is. Only two of them that I can find have even made a campaign contribution because they've been sequestered on the federal bench up to this point. So money does corrupt the political process. It has been given a freer path. You know, let me give just one example of how this can work. One could make contributions to every leadership PAC of members of Congress. Now, leadership PACs can be converted to personal use. You know, maybe the House ethics and Senate ethics preclude that, but that's only for active members. Once you're out, you can cash that in and use it for personal purposes. That's corrupting. And if there are no limits on how much of that an individual or a group of individuals can do, there is going to be a great deal more corruption. Public policy will be bent to the whims of the money.
Richard, what do you make of that? I mean, the court seems to be kind of restricted to this quid pro quo definition of corruption. And you have politicians who, I think, would readily admit there's a gray area that doesn't fall within that definition. And I think that's what you're getting at, Rich, is that, you know, some of the campaign finance laws were designed by politicians because they know their climate and know kind of a threshold at which 117,000 sounds rather arbitrary, but that measure might be where they draw the line in terms of anything more is corrupting in some fashion. What do you make of that gray area? How does that fall within what we're talking
about?
Well,
what I say is that gray area is exactly where we're going to be fighting, because the question is this concept of appearance of quid pro quo corruption, it's not really corruption, but it sort of looks like it. Is that sufficient reason to limit First Amendment political speech? And I argue it doesn't. On the other hand, I absolutely agree with Rich. Money alone can be corrupting, particularly direct contributions to candidates can be corrupting. Now, he has to, by eliminating the aggregate limits in McCutcheon, he then has to come up with some imaginary horribles about giving to multiple committees and moving the money around, and that could happen. But at the end of the day, it's the idea that what's more important, the political rights of people to speak in our system, democratic system. Right now, the majority of people in this state and the majority of powers would rather limit it. They don't like the First Amendment. In fact, many people want to limit the thing. Money is speech in some sense in our society. If you're going to buy a television ad, if you're going to actually speak other than on a street corner, it does take money. And this is the finding of the court. I'm not making this up. Rich would like to turn that back, and I think that would be a significant opening to then really erode the First Amendment in the same way he is worked up about McCutcheon. I would be very worked up about any rolling back of the idea that money is speech.
Well, I think it is fair to say, though, that the justices in the past have limited speech under the First Amendment. I mean, First Amendment is not a blanket. And we're not just talking about the yelling rat or fire in a crowded movie theater. They have, in occasion, limited speech in the past. Correct, Rich?
Well, yes. Justice Stevens went to great length in Citizens United discussing the various ways that speech can be limited. But, you know, these are not imaginary horribles. People like Warren Rudman, Alan Simpson, Christopher Shays, testified convincingly to the court about the nature of how money corrupts the political process. It's not imaginary to those who are involved in the process.
Richard, does this have a potential, or either of you really, does this have a potential, and I think, fair or not, we're looking at now, this at least in the short term, seems to benefit the GOP. I think that's where everyone's going. I mean, I think long term it could benefit all political parties. But short term, if we just take that for granted, does this have a potential, at least short term, to backfire for the GOP to as they're trying to wrest away the image of them being a party for the wealthy or for corporations and kind of... You know, does the GOP have an image problem to worry about here with this?
The problem, that isn't the problem, but certainly it has backfired.
Uh-huh.
The last election, we had several of these really totally unqualified lunatic candidates that would get some millionaire to support them, and Republicans would control the U.S. Senate, other than the fact that large amounts of money can come in and support a candidate. So there's some downsides to it for the Republicans. Republicans have an uncanny ability to shoot themselves in the foot a lot of times by they're taking all this money that they have and coming up with policy prescriptions that simply are out of tune with where the public is. And we've seen that probably in the social issues recently. So, but if you tell me overall, sure, Republicans have more rich people. The Democrats have lots of rich people who are willing to spend a lot of money. So it's a lot more even than they thought. I mean, Obama raised $1 billion last election. Now he raised it through a very sophisticated system, but a lot of Wall Street money went behind him. So I think at the end of the day, anytime there's an advantage for one, the next election round, the other side figures out how to undermine that. And like I say, Republicans have an ability to shoot themselves in the foot no matter how much money they have.
Well, I think the point that you bring up there, I think, is a point for maybe both parties need to take into consideration is that, you know, with this kind of with this ruling, it has a potential for parties to risk becoming even more out of touch, I think, with what the American public wants by listening to only this select class of donors that have more of a voice. Rich?
Certainly Democrats can be corrupted as well.
Of
the
course.
Whole treatment of Wall Street is reflective of that. As far as where this is going, though, this is part of a step-by-step process. The next thing we're going to see is the reversal of the prohibition against direct corporate contributions to candidates.
Well, Clarence Thomas kind of hinted that in his concurring.
Well, he's way off, but Jim Bopp has applied for cert for an Iowa Right to Life case where in the state of Iowa, unions can make contributions directly to candidates, corporations cannot. That will be the vehicle to undo the prohibition against direct corporate contributions to candidates. I see that Senator McConnell has accumulated a number of overage contributions, and I expect he's positioning himself to be the plaintiff to argue the case that we just need to liberate money a little bit more and just eliminate contribution limits altogether. So this is a process. This seems to be Chief Justice Roberts' life cause on the court. You know, Chief Justice Warren wanted to desegregate the South. I guess Chief Justice Roberts sees himself as the servant of the American Church of the Almighty Dollar.
I would say that Rich's exact, until he went off on Justice Roberts, he's exactly right that this is an organized effort. And Mr. Bopp, who's bringing a number of these cases, I've been involved in this whole effort for over 25 years. And that is step by step to take the cases before the court and to expand political speech and expand the use of money in our system. So in that sense, he's exactly right. These battles, like civil rights, like other rights, they go on for decades in the court as you fight over these fundamental issues. And this battle is not going away. It is true there could be some setbacks if the makeup of the court 5-4, it could be 4-5, and all of a sudden repeal Citizens United, and so these fights will go on and on and on forever. They've been going on for 200 years.
And Richard, you touched on it, and I want to bring it back here to Michigan. You know, what, if any, effect would this ruling have on we have all kinds of races coming up here in November. What, if any, effect might this have at all now? Can you see anything at all, Richard?
We have a very important U.S. Senate race.
Correct.
We have a number of congressional vacancies now, a couple of them anyway, and you could potentially see these changes. When these changes occur, why, it takes a few months for people to get organized. Super PACs didn't happen overnight, but they sure began to happen. I talked to Senator McConnell once, and I said, well, Senator, do you think any statewide race in the future can be run without super PACs? He said, no. He said, with the money that it takes to run a U.S. Senate race, they are now part of the system. So I think the system will change. There will be more money. Political parties may be strengthened. That's one of the
positive
benefits.
I was going to bring
benefits.
That up, yeah.
And that,
yeah.
That is not a bad thing. I think, in some respects, a stronger political party system. Now, it may make a bigger fight over control of that party all of a sudden, even from the establishment and the Tea Party types and the Republican side or in the Democratic Party, which is basically a subsidiary of the unions at this point in Michigan. It may change and be a broader-based party. So arguably things will change. They will not be the same. Every election cycle is different. The weapons people use, the sophistication of technology, television ads are kind of going away, and other kinds of media. So the campaigns are different, and this law or this McCutcheon decision will affect us in ways that we don't really know. One of the wealthy people I talked to, and I'll stop here, was very concerned. He says, unfortunately, I'm the kind of guy who can give the money, this is his assistant, to a lot of people. I used to be able to say no when we got to 100 and some thousand. I could say no.
They lost their
out. Now they know I don't have that argument. That is a problem for some of these very wealthy people that get hit up by everybody. And it happens. It's one of the best practical arguments. I happen to disagree with it constitutionally. But limits are good because politicians, there is no limit to what they can ask for. They will ask for if they can.
Rich Robinson, is that a silver lining in this for you, that it seems a lot of folks are seeing that the political parties might wrest a little bit more control back from these super PACs where they don't have as much control or any control over what's going on?
Well, the fact that there are no limits whatever on giving to the nonprofits, there's the benefit of anonymity. Yes, maybe on the margins the parties will have a little bit more money, but they have been eclipsed by the other groups. But let me give you a hypothetical example of what could happen, what's potentially at stake here with a joint fundraising committee. In this state, the DeVos family gives money to politics like no one else. If you took the adult members of the nuclear DeVos family, say Justin Amash set up a joint fundraising committee for candidates, party, and PACs, those nine family members could give $40 million instantly, $57 million in the course of a two-year election cycle, and Justin Amash could go into the caucus room with $90,000 for every member of his caucus, $45,000 of which would be for the leadership PACs. Now, he could say, my donor friends don't want anything. But you know what they like and what they don't like.
And that's the situation where we're in with these joint fundraising committees who might be left with the ability to move money around. Maybe they might be used a little bit more with this new.
Yeah, I would argue if you can use a joint fundraising, you'll do it. I mean, we created 20 years ago because of limits. We helped create the Michigan Senatorial Trust, which was a series of committees. The utilities had a ballot, a $40,000 limit on ballot campaigns, and they created 1,000 different committees. So whatever, if you create these limits, people will find a way around them, and these kinds of you take the numbers and then push them to the extreme, and then pick somebody like the Koch brothers or in Michigan, the DeVos interests, and you can come up with some scary pictures. The DeVos people give a lot of money, and they will continue to give.
Well, gentlemen, it's been a robust conversation. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate you taking the time. We could probably blow out the rest of the hour, but we'll leave it there. We'll leave it there. Rich Robinson is the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, and Richard McClellan is a longtime Lansing attorney and GOP power broker. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.